Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 350, titled, The One Who Killed Kennedy Was Trained for 3 Years, unquote. This is being recorded on March 3rd of 2002. We're going to be examining some of the many circumstances in and around the vitally important and terrifying events of September 11th of 2001. This is a huge event which in many ways has opened a vista not only on the past but on the future, or I should say not only on the future but the past, and which in turn has profound implications for the future. It yields profound understanding of the past, and this is an enormous event which is going to embrace many, many topics. What we're going to be doing in this broadcast is taking a look at an infiltrator into U.S. intelligence and law enforcement. We've taken a look at this fellow in For the Record 338, and we reprised that information last week, number 349. His name is Ali Mohammed. He worked in the Egyptian army and at the same time served as a double agent for Al-Qaeda and for Muslim fundamentalist organizations, working inside of FBI, CIA, and also apparently the U.S. military, again, doubling on those institutions. In connection with the September 11th attacks, I have voiced my opinion that basically a fascist fifth column within U.S. intelligence involving a profoundly powerful elements and also a fifth column within the U.S. political and economic establishment associated with the Bormann Organization, what I call the Underground Reich, and embracing the White House was the executive authority in these attacks. In terms of revealing the past and also helping to understand the present, we're going to take a look at a couple of interesting aspects of Ali Mohammed. We're going to be taking a look at evidentiary tributaries between Ali Mohammed and, first of all, the assassination of Anwar Sadat. And in that context, we're going to take a look at connections with an organization that we focused on in, among other programs, For the Record 343. That organization is an Islamo-fascist organization called the Muslim Brotherhood. It worked with the Third Reich and fascist Italy. Its founder, Hassan al-Banna, in many ways patterned the Muslim Brotherhood after the European fascist movements. And it is alleged in the book Dollars for Terror by Richard Labeviere, which we're going to be using again, that Youssef Nada of Nada Management and Al-Taqwa, whose assets were frozen by the U.S. in the wake of September 11th, it is alleged that Youssef Nada, an acknowledged member of the Muslim Brotherhood, was also working for Third Reich intelligence in Egypt, specifically working for the Abwehr of Admiral Wilhelm Canaris. Again, discussion on that in For the Record 343. Now, turning to the Wall Street Journal article of November 26th, 2001, that deals with Ali Mohammed. This article is titled The Infiltrator, Ali Mohammed Served in the U.S. Army and Bin Laden's Circle, subtitled Lapses in Handling Sergeant Mere Larger Failings in FBI's Terror Policing. This article was co-authored by Peter Waldman, Gerald F. Seib, Jerry Markin, and Christopher Cooper. Now, of Ali Mohammed, his background, and his participation in Egypt's Islamic Jihad that killed President Sadat, we read, born in Alexandria in 1952, Mr. Mohammed followed his father's lead into the Egyptian military, rising to the rank of major in Egypt's special forces. A skilled linguist, he often protected Egyptian diplomats overseas and participated in joint training with American forces in Egypt and the U.S. While still in the army, Mr. Mohammed secretly joined Egypt's Islamic Jihad extremist movement, the group that assassinated President Sadat in 1981, according to his guilty plea in the embassy bombing case. Now, what we're going to look at in the context of the assassination of Anwar Sadat is the Muslim Brotherhood. And in turn, as I've stressed in the past, one wants to avoid oversimplification or rationalization in connection with political events. That's often easier said than done, but one wants to attempt to understand institutions in terms of their complexity and their interrelationship with other institutions. Now, in this context, we're going to be taking a look at the Muslim Brotherhood and its oscillation on behalf of and against various Egyptian leaders. In turn, we're going to take a look at the Central Intelligence Agency, which worked with the Muslim Brotherhood in some periods. One of those was when they attempted, that is to say the CIA, worked with the Muslim Brotherhood in its attempts to weaken or oust President Nasser of Egypt. Now, bear in mind that in, among other programs, For the Record 340, and also in RFA 22, we took a look at the fact that Nasser, who wanted help forming his intelligence service and specifically wanted help against the Muslim Brotherhood, turned to the CIA. And in turn, the CIA, wanting to assist Nasser but not wishing to alienate Israel, oddly enough, turned to the Galen Organization and through that to the Odessa and Otto Skorzeny, who dispatched a number of Third Reich veterans, many of them war criminals and SS operatives of the First Order. They in turn were used by Nasser to put together his intelligence service, and that in turn was used against the Muslim Brotherhood, which at the same time had a long-standing relationship not only with Nazi Germany in its above ground and in its post-World War II underground capacity, but the Muslim Brotherhood was the target, ostensibly at least, of this Odessa/Galen CIA contingent that was working on behalf of Nasser. So again, understand the complexities and the oscillations, avoid oversimplification, and note the complex and interchanging roles of such organizations here as the Muslim Brotherhood and elements of CIA. Now, in turn, bear in mind Ali Mohammed's connections to the assassination of Anwar Sadat, and bear in mind that Ali Mohammed himself is a graphic microcosm of some of these oscillations and some of these varying loyalties or split loyalties, and again, avoid oversimplification. Turning now to the book Dollars for Terror, subtitled The United States in Islam, this was authored by Richard Labeviere, Labeviere. It was published in softcover by Algora Publishing out of New York. It was translated by Martin Demers, Demers. You can visit Algora's website at www.algora.com. The book was originally published in 1999 in French, and then was published in the year 2000 in English. The ISBN number 1-892941-06-6. Now, after Nasser came to power, and bear in mind that the Free Officers Association, of which Nasser and Anwar Sadat were members, had worked with Nazi Germany and with the Muslim Brotherhood in the Second World War, the goal to being to oust the British, and also to keep Jews from emigrating to what was to become Israel. However, Nasser was part of the left-wing branch of the Free Officers Association, which overthrew King Farouk, and as such, he later incurred the wrath of the Muslim Brotherhood. When Nasser aligned himself with the former Soviet Union, the CIA, in turn, allied itself with the Muslim Brotherhood. Bear in mind, it was the CIA that helped to provide Nasser with the Galen Skorzeny contingent that helped to put together his secret service. That, obviously, was a direct outgrowth of the Underground Reich. The Muslim Brotherhood had worked with the Third Reich and the Underground Reich. Turning now to Dollars for Terror, after Nasser turned to the Soviet Union, we see, it was during this period that the first financial and logistical aid came from the CIA, who bet on the fraternity, that's Labeviere's nickname for the Muslim Brotherhood, who bet on the fraternity to destabilize the Ra'is, who had just chosen the Soviet camp. And the reconstituted military branch of the Brotherhood still hoped to overthrow Nasser. In January of 1965, it started preparations for a new showdown. From Moscow on August 29, 1965, Nasser announced the discovery of a new plot fomented by the Muslim Brothers but thwarted by the security services. A second massive repression by Nasser was then launched against the fraternity. Skipping down. Forced into clandestine activity for another 5 years, the organization, parenthetically the Brotherhood, reemerged from its ashes only upon Nasser's death and Sadat's arrival on October 15, 1970. The accession of Anwar al-Sadat to the presidency of the Egyptian Republic supported the political re-entry of the fraternity, whose many activities were once again permitted. Nasser's successor, who wanted to put an end to the partnership between Egypt and the USSR, counted on the brothers to counterbalance the weight of the pro-Soviet faction of the regime. So Sadat, after succeeding Nasser, allowed the Muslim Brotherhood to come back above ground and was hoping that the power of the Muslim Brotherhood could serve as a counterbalance to the weight of the pro-Soviet faction of the government that had been allied with Nasser. So again, note the shifting allegiances here. Once again, however, under Sadat's presidency, when Sadat sought a détente with Israel and signed the Camp David Accords, the Muslim Brotherhood turned a murderous vengeance and antipathy toward Anwar Sadat. Turning once again to Dollars for Terror, the fraternity joined forces for the first time with the Egyptian left in its savage opposition to the rapprochement with Israel preached by Sadat. It adopted an attitude of open hostility from the moment the Camp David Accords were signed on September 17, 1978. It denounced the Israeli-Egyptian peace treaty of March 26, 1979, and during the summer of the same year waged a campaign against the normalization of relations between the two countries. Skipping down again, speaking of the Brotherhood, their newspapers were confiscated again, but Sadat hesitated to destroy an organization that he still thought might be of use against his real enemy, the Egyptian left. Still, he could not avoid taking a tougher tone following the new denominational incidents that caused bloodshed in Upper Egypt from June to September 1981. Sheikh Omar Telmasani was sent to prison along with several preachers from the fraternity. The assassination of President Sadat on October 6, 1981, by a commando proclaiming Islamist ideology, has been implicitly attributed to the Muslim Brothers. Since they had based their historical legitimacy on the hegemonic control that they still claim to exert over the entire Islamist movement, the Brothers had difficulty denying any ties with the assassins. Bear in mind that among the organizations involved with this was the Egyptian Islamic Jihad. Among the people associated with that were the aforementioned Ali Mohammed and Osama bin Laden's right-hand man in al-Qaeda, still apparently at large, that is Dr. al-Zawahiri. Continuing, once again, this being the assassination of Anwar Sadat, the saber cut across the Quran in their emblem. Although the material implication of the Brotherhood could not be proven during the trial, the international public considered them to be behind the assassination. This was a problematic responsibility for the movement, which, ever since then, has protested its dedication to, quote, peaceful reformism, unquote. Nonetheless, the specter of Sadat still tarnishes the image of the Muslim Brothers and their semi-clandestine existence. What we're going to look at next is the curious behavior of the leadership of the so-called supreme guide of the Muslim Brotherhood, that is Mustafa Masrur. After being imprisoned three times in 1948, in 1954, and 1965, Mustafa Masrur was promoted. When the brothers were released from prison at the beginning of Anwar al-Sadat's presidency, the military branch of the order, constructed in the 1940s, reconstituted itself under the name of the Special Order, unquote. Consequently, this armed group has run the Egyptian and international branches of the organization. Masrur was one of the heads of the Special Order, so it is absolutely natural that he is the new supreme guide today. Strangely, he left Egypt just a few days before the assassination of Sadat, unquote. Masrur returned to Egypt only in 1986, and from that time on, he devoted himself entirely to making the International Organization of the Brothers in the service of the Arab Volunteers for Afghanistan. By the way, parenthetically, Ali Mohammed was working with the anti-Soviet Afghan effort as well. He was, of course, to become a double agent against the United States. My take on the milieu that was involved in the September 11th attacks, as well as other attacks in and outside of the United States, ranging from the first attack on the World Trade Center in 1993 to the bombings of the U.S. embassies, was that the anti-Soviet Islamo-fascist milieu, an Islamic fundamentalist milieu that we allied ourselves with, could be considered to be functioning as a Trojan horse, not unlike the analysis that I presented in RFA 37, how the United States lost the Second World War. It is my belief that the Galen Organization and what I call the Underground Reich, while ostensibly working with the United States, was actually looking to manipulate anti-communism in such a way as to infiltrate us and to ultimately bring us down. As we've seen among other works, some of our discussions with Martin A. Lee, the author of The Beast Reawakens, and in particular, Kevin Coogan, the author of Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parker Yockey and the Postwar Fascist International, the elements of the Underground Reich, or what I call the Underground Reich, specifically elements of Odessa, elements of the Galen Organization, elements of what Kevin Coogan calls the Postwar Fascist International, were also reaching out to the former Soviet Union, as well as Communist China and elements in the Third World, this at the same time as they were working with U.S. intelligence and representing themselves as our allies. I believe basically that the Underground Reich and the Galen Organization have functioned as a Trojan horse, both vis-a-vis the U.S.-Soviet struggle of the Cold War period and also vis-a-vis the United States' relationship with the Third World. And I believe that many of the Islamic fundamentalist or Islamo-fascist elements, as I call them, were basically just as determined to destroy the United States and ultimately Israel as well, probably first Israel, then the United States, as they were willing to fight against the Soviet Union. And I believe that elements of this Islamo-fascist milieu working with the Underground Reich basically doubled on the United States on September 11th. Turning once again to Mustafa Mashour and his Afghan adventures. Mashour returned to Egypt, that again having left just a few days before the assassination of Sadat. Mashour returned to Egypt only in 1986, and from that time on, he devoted himself entirely to making the International Organization of the Brothers in the service of the Arab Volunteers for Afghanistan. Quote, "At the time, he saw that holy war as heralding the creation of a future Islamic state in Afghanistan," unquote, adds his former counterpart, again quoting, "At the time, the fraternity saw that country as the first site for the refounding of the caliphate, the only political structure likely to unite all the Muslims one day." Today, Mashour is 77 years old. The Egyptian Special Services, which never lose sight of him, believe that he is still as radical as ever, and that he runs the Special Order, and that organization still maintains contacts with the armed groups currently operating in Egypt, that is, Gama and Jihad, Jihad being is Egyptian Islamic Jihad, with which Ali Mohammed is associated, as well as Dr. al-Zawahiri. What we're going to look at next is we're going to review a short section of Dollars for Terror, and we're going to take a look at the Special Order, or the military branch of the Muslim Brotherhood. This by way of review from For the Record Program 343 of the aforementioned Youssef Nada of Al-Taqwa and the Nada Management and Al-Taqwa. Youssef Nada is even better known to the Egyptian services, who have evidence of his membership in the armed branch of the fraternity of the Muslim Brothers in the 1940s. At that time, according to the same sources, he, Nada, was working for the Abwehr under Admiral Wilhelm Canaris and took part in a plot against King Farouk. This was not the first time that the path of the Muslim Brothers crossed that of the servants of the Third Reich. The founder of the fraternity himself, Hassan al-Banna, served as an intermediary between those who went on to become the free officers, in particular Anwar al-Sadat, and the agents of Nazi Germany. Quote, "The missions assigned to the Abwehr from this point forward began to go beyond simple military information," write Roger Farigaud and Remy Coffert. "The agents of Canaris would try to engage men of power in the great German plan, along with clandestine nationalists, ethnic groups with separatist aspirations, whole regions ready to rise up against the two empires that really counted, the French and the British, unquote. In 1954, Youssef Nader would also be implicated in the preparation of the failed plot against Nasser before he fled to Germany and finally to Italy. So again, avoid oversimplification. Note that Anwar al-Sadat was originally associated with the Free Officers Association. Like Nasser, he worked on behalf of the Third Reich in combination with, allegedly, people like Youssef Nader. But then when Nasser assumed the head of the new Egyptian government and Gravity was part of the left branch of the Free Officers, the Muslim Brotherhood, eventually with the assistance of the CIA, turned against Nasser. And in turn, of course, it was the CIA Skorzeny Galen contingent that Nasser employed against the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, turning once again to Ali Mohammed. He eventually was involved with a milieu that were implicated in the 1993 attack on the World Trade Center. The mastermind of that attack, as we've seen in the past, was Ramzi Youssef, and there are evidentiary tributaries not only linking Ramzi Youssef to the Oklahoma City bombing, but there are very hard connections linking Ramzi Youssef with Al-Qaeda. And speaking of some of the paramilitary training of the bombers, this, by the way, turning back once again to the Wall Street Journal of Monday, November 26th of 2001, the bomber's paramilitary trainer, Mr. Mohammed, was highly educated, having earned two bachelor's degrees and a master's degree at the University of Alexandria in Egypt. Ramzi Youssef, the calculating mastermind of the bombing, was found in Pakistan in a house paid for by the Bin Laden network. It turned out that he was closely associated with a Saudi Arabian businessman named Mohammed Jamal Khalifa, who happens to be Mr. Bin Laden's brother-in-law. Now, we're going to take a look at a passage once again from the Wall Street Journal of Monday, November 26th of 2001. Mr. Mohammed helped to train the bombers who were involved in the first World Trade Center attack. The mastermind was Ramzi Youssef, an associate of Bin Laden. And one of the proteges of Ali Mohammed was in turn talking to Sheikh Omar. This is Omar Rahman, who was convicted in connection with the operations surrounding the first World Trade Center attack. By the way, his son has been apprehended in Afghanistan as part of the Al-Qaeda network. A very, very interesting bit of dialogue was captured by the FBI, who had bugged Sheikh Omar Rahman's apartment. As federal investigators were about to discover, they were terrorists intent on striking again. These are the bombers of the World Trade Center the first time around. In May of 1993, 3 months after the bombing, Sheikh Omar was speaking with one of his disciples at his Jersey City, New Jersey apartment when the man asked whether it would be acceptable in Islam to bomb the FBI's Manhattan headquarters. Quote, "Slow down. Slow down a little bit," the Sheikh cautioned, whispering for fear the FBI was bugging his apartment, which it was. Quote, "The one who killed Kennedy was trained for 3 years," unquote. It was never made clear in later court testimony which assassination the Sheikh was talking about. What we're going to look at for much of the rest of the broadcast is a very interesting affidavit that was submitted by a fellow named Robert Byron Watson. Robert Byron Watson overheard some plotters who were allegedly involved and apparently involved in the assassination of Martin Luther King and Robert F. Kennedy. Those two assassinations took place in April and June of 1968. And in turn, these assassinations were, according to the information developed, connected with the assassination of President Kennedy. There are numerous evidentiary tributaries connecting both Kennedy assassinations with the assassination of Martin Luther King and with the attempt on George Wallace's life in 1972, which eliminated him as a potential third-party challenger to spoil Richard Nixon's 72 re-election bid. What we're going to look at now is a piece of information about the Robert Byron Watson affidavit, and this will serve as a vista upon an apparent part of the plot to kill Martin Luther King, which in turn was connected to the plot against Robert Kennedy's life and which reflects backward on the assassination of President Kennedy. Turning now to a book called Government by Gunplay, subtitled Assassination Conspiracy Theories from Dallas to Today. This book was edited by Sid Blumenthal and Harvey Yazijian of the Assassination Information Bureau. This is an essay by Jeff Cohen, who later went on to become involved with Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. It's called The Assassination of Martin Luther King. Skipping into this essay, we read, "The newest lead in this case comes from 21-year-old Robert Byron Watson, who as a high school student worked part-time for an art import business in Atlanta. The young employee says he soon realized that the business was actually a front for a gun exporting and drug importing operation. On the afternoon of March 28, 1968, Watson claims to have overheard a conversation involving the four business partners and several strangers. Quote, "I heard one partner saying in a very clear voice that he was going to shoot that damn nigger bastard King in the head and frame a jailbird just as they had Kennedy. Another partner said that they would kill Dr. King exactly 1 week from then to the day and at about the same time of day," unquote. The conspirators, Watson states, left the country shortly after the murder and didn't return until Ray was apprehended in London 9 weeks later. Watson contends he has been beaten, blackmailed, and framed by corrupt drug enforcement agents because of his attempts to expose his boss's illegalities. From his current residence in federal prison, he has released a rambling 34-page affidavit packed with names, dates, addresses, and telephone numbers. Atlanta police began investigating Watson's affidavit in June of 1975. Detectives talked with 11 law enforcement agencies and 35 witnesses. A police spokesman stated in early July, quote, "This is not a routine investigation. Much of the information appears to be true. It could open new leads involving a conspiracy," unquote. As the investigation continued, however, Atlanta's black police commissioner accused the FBI of being uncooperative. By the end of July, the commissioner, Reginald Eves, announced that while, quote, "names and places and dates have been corroborated, involvement of individuals named as conspiring to kill Dr. King could not be substantiated," unquote. Eves told a TV audience in November of 1975, quote, "We could not establish a conspiracy because of limited geographical control. Our investigation indicates a strong possibility of conspiracy," unquote. The Atlanta police report has been delivered to the U.S. Justice Department. And that, again, from an essay by Jeff Cohen in the book Government by Gunplay, edited by Sid Blumenthal and Harvey Yazijian. By the way, that was published in softcover by Signet Books, copyright 1976. And that is a book that we've used in a number of other broadcasts, including RFA number 8 about the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King. And inside two of this program, we're going to listen to an excerpt of RFA program number 8, and we're going to take a look once again at the Robert Byron Watson affidavit. The title of the program is a direct quote from Sheikh Omar Rahman, who was convicted in connection with the first set of attacks on the World Trade Center and related conspiracies. He was taped discussing with one of his associates, who in turn was part of the milieu trained by Ali Mohammed, an infiltrator into U.S. intelligence on behalf of al-Qaeda. This particular individual was discussing with Sheikh Rahman whether it would violate Islamic law to blow up FBI headquarters in Manhattan. Sheikh Rahman was then quoted as saying, "Slow down, slow it down a little bit. The one who killed Kennedy was trained for 3 years." And then the Wall Street Journal of 11/26/2001 goes on to add that it was not clear what assassination he was talking about. What we're going to be doing as the first item up, so to speak, in this side is excerpting a section of RFA program number 8 that is about the assassination of Martin Luther King. As we've looked at in numerous broadcasts, including The Guns of November Part 4 and RFA number 8, among others, there are numerous evidentiary tributaries connecting the assassinations of both John Kennedy in November of 1963 with that of his brother Robert in June of 1968, and in turn connecting those assassinations to the assassination of Martin Luther King 2 months before Robert Kennedy was killed, and in turn those assassinations have strong evidentiary tributaries running to the shooting of George Wallace in May of 1972. Now, it is my belief, and this is conjectural, that Sheikh Rahman was alluding to the assassination of Robert Kennedy. The patsy in the Robert Kennedy assassination was a Palestinian Arab named Saran Saran. As we looked at in RFA program number 9, dealing with the assassination of Robert Kennedy, the evidence suggesting that Saran was not the assassin but was the carefully manipulated patsy is very, very strong indeed. Saran, however, was a Palestinian Arab who ostensibly wanted to kill Robert Kennedy because of his support for Israel. The evidence suggests very strongly that, in fact, it was the same type of elements, in fact, the same elements who killed Robert Kennedy, the elements who killed Robert Kennedy were the same as those who had killed his brother and Martin Luther King. We concluded side one by examining a section of the book Government by Gunplay, co-authored or co-edited by Sid Blumenthal and Harvey Azizian. In turn, we looked at an essay about the assassination of Martin Luther King by Jeff Cohen, now associated with Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. In turn, that essay dealt with, among other things, an affidavit submitted by Robert Byron Watson, who was working at the Magellan Art Gallery in Atlanta, Georgia. As we're going to look at in this excerpt of RFA program number 8, Robert Byron Watson had come across apparent elements of the assassination plot against Martin Luther King and against Robert Kennedy. Robert Kennedy was killed 2 months after Martin Luther King. And these assassinations, in turn, as we've looked at in other broadcasts, link up with the assassination of John Kennedy. Among the elements that you're going to hear described here are former U.S. Representative Larry McDonald of Georgia. Larry McDonald was in turn associated with Western Goals, an ultra-right-wing private intelligence organization that, among other things, was utilizing elements of the Los Angeles Police Department's Public Disorder and Intelligence Division to spy on people in Los Angeles. That case was the focal point of a civil suit, and before Larry McDonald could give evidence in that case, he was killed Korean Airlines Flight 007 was brought down. That was a major incident in the Cold War, and the evidence would suggest that it was not, in fact, the Soviets who brought that down, but that was the official version in what appears to have been either a provocation and or some other type of manipulated incident. We haven't got time to go into that now, but note the following excerpt from RFA 8, this is about the assassination of Robert Kennedy. Do note that Larry McDonald was connected with this milieu. Note, in particular, the name of Fuad Habash. Fuad Habash's name was apparently part of Fuad Habash, I should say, the brother of George Habash, about whom we're going to say more in a few minutes. Fuad Habash was connected to the group that appears, from the information we're about to hear, to have been connected to killing not only Martin Luther King, but also Robert Kennedy. Bear in mind that the patsy for the assassination of Robert Kennedy, Saran Saran, was a Palestinian Arab. It is my belief that Rahman was alluding to Saran Saran in the belief that it was actually Saran who committed the assassination. But note the name of Fuad Habash and the name of Anthony Malek, and note the connection of Fuad Habash to his brother George. This is from RFA number 8, recorded on April 4th, 1985, in addition to my own voice. You will also hear the voice of my very charming and capable former co-host, Nip Tuck, who assisted me with the on-air responsibilities.
Now, this article is entitled, this again, from the Hudson Valley Chronicle, July of 1977, Volume 1, Number 1. The article is entitled, King Assassination Conspiracy Revealed. This is by a man named David Wemple, W-E-M-P-L-E. And Wemple writes, through nearly a decade of threats, blackmail, beatings, and murder attempts, Robert Byron Watson has steadfastly maintained that both the United States federal government and the forces of organized crime have persecuted, framed, and imprisoned him for one reason and one reason only, that he possesses knowledge implicating agents of these groups in a conspiracy to murder Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and others. For those willing to hear his story, it should become readily apparent why the endless mysteries of America's political assassinations remain unsolved. When the intimacy existing between government, organized crime, and the intelligence community is laid out before one's eyes, it must seriously be questioned whether or not our present form of government can weather the intense scrutiny to which such knowledge must lead us. Watson was but a young man when on March 28, 1968, he claims to have overheard a portion of the conspiracy to murder Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. As an acknowledged authority on art history and archaeology, even by those whom he most closely identifies with the conspiracy, he became employed at Magellan's Art Gallery in Atlanta, Georgia, and worked at the pricing of various artifacts. Magellan, by the way, is M-A-G-E-L-L-O-N. The gallery's business associates were fighting amongst themselves, however, by Christmas of 1967. It wasn't until a year or so later that Watson learned of the reason for this split. Bill Arnett, A-R-N-E-T-T, one of the original gallery partners, had apparently begun to suspect several others of using the gallery to front for illegal operations involving what Byron Watson consistently refers to in statements as, quote, the syndicate, unquote. The type of individual who often found his way to the halls of Magellan's, according to Watson, was characterized by a rather frequent visitor named Larry McDonald. A United States representative from Georgia, McDonald reigns from Marietta, from which the awesome and scandal-ridden Lockheed Corporation bases its East Coast operations. Aside from his membership on the John Birch Society's National Council, McDonald has been accused by the U.S. Labor Party and others of acting as a conduit for intelligence operations and various ultra-right-wing groups. In the meantime, he has gained a notoriety of sorts by saturating the congressional record with tirades like Maoist subversives in U.S. factories and Martin Luther King Jr.'s relationship with the communists. Within such an atmosphere of reactionary politics and corruption, says Watson, syndicate operations flourished, which included gold bullion smuggling from South America, as well as the importation upon a truly vast scale of cocaine and heroin.
Okay, skipping along in the article. The operations into which Byron Watson gradually became involved through this blackmail brought him an ever-increasing knowledge of organized crime and its relationship to the U.S. federal government. Although deeply involved in narcotics-related activities, he steadfastly maintains that he never took an active role in the actual trafficking, and that any, quote, evidence of this has been fabricated in a successful attempt to have him framed and imprisoned for the knowledge which he possesses. His awareness of drug smuggling activities, however, is substantial. While visiting Southeast Asia and purchasing huge amounts of artifacts for sale at Magellan's, for instance, he noticed that his traveling companion, Bill Jackson, was buying large quantities of teak logs. They were hollowed out at points, filled with narcotics, and shipped back to the U.S. I should just mention that Bill Jackson, mentioned here in the article, is one of the people I believe that was mentioned, as along with Gene Purcell and Bill Jackson's brother, Herman Jackson, as being the people that were having a discussion with Jerry Adams about these people all, of course, being Byron Watson's employers, about the assassination of Martin Luther King. We're going to get back to Herman Jackson a little later on, but remember that Herman Jackson is one of the people involved in this, and this is his brother Bill Jackson that Watson is claiming was involved with buying these teak logs. Okay. These teak logs were hollowed out at points, filled with narcotics, and shipped back to the U.S. A good deal of this information was forwarded by Watson to Atlanta Public Safety Commissioner A. Reginald Eaves. Eaves, whose, quote, conscience forced him to launch an investigation of Watson's charges in the summer of 1975, conceded that his drug-related data, at least, had proven to be, quote, about 95% accurate, unquote. The leads which Watson has provided in regards to the intimacy between government and syndicate, as well as about political assassinations, therefore may well be something to be reckoned with.
As fate would have it, Watson's hurried journey to Chile would provide a vital piece to the puzzle of the King assassination. It was while in Santiago that Byron found it literally impossible to receive any funds which had been sent to him from home. When there was some more money to be had, he was befriended by the South American director of the National Front for the Liberation of Palestine, Fuad Habash Ansara, whose brother George Habash is the leader of the National Front. Habash and Watson, as it turned out, had a mutual acquaintance who often visited Magellan's in Atlanta. That man, Dr. Anthony N. Malik, was the party named by Watson as buying the gold bullion which was being smuggled into the United States by Herman Jackson. Recall that Herman Jackson is the alias which apparently Jack Youngblood used, or someone who used a number of different names, including Jack Youngblood. Habash and others apparently suspected Malik of being a double agent with the CIA, a possibility which surfaced when Malik traveled to Chile immediately prior to the CIA-inspired coup d'etat against Allende in 1973. If Habash's suspicions were correct, Malek was one of those CIA agents who had attempted to infiltrate such national liberation organizations as the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the PLO, and the National Front for the Liberation of Palestine. The Central Intelligence Agency has, in fact, carried out infiltrative and provocative acts against such American groups as the American Indian Movement, Black Panthers, and Students for a Democratic Society. Later in 1974, Watson claims that Herman Jackson told him that Malek was also, quote, the man who conceived most of the plan and worked out most of the details which were employed to assassinate Senator Robert Kennedy.
Now, again, note the name of Fuad Habash, who was part of that milieu, apparently involved, at least according to Robert Byron Watson, whose allegations were to a considerable extent, as we looked at in Side 1, supported by subsequent investigations, of the name of Fuad Habash, the brother of George Habash, should be noted in that regard. Note also that one of the associates of Fuad Habash was Anthony Malek, according to Robert Byron Watson, one of the key players in the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. And again, the patsy in that assassination, Saran. Saran was a Palestinian Arab who supposedly killed Robert Kennedy because of his antipathy to Kennedy's support for Israel. Now, what we're going to look at next is the political heritage of George Habash, the brother of Fuad Habash. We're going to be turning once again to the landmark text, Dreamer of the Day, subtitled Francis Parker Yockey and the Postwar Fascist International. That was authored by Kevin Coogan, published in softcover by Otano Media, Incorporated, and it was copyright 1999. The ISBN number 1-57027-039-2. The book, by the way, was edited by Dave Mandel, an on-air personality at sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey. We're going to be taking a look now at François Genoux. We've spoken about Genoux in, among other programs, For the Record 333. We came back to Genoux in For the Record program number 341. We've also looked at Genoux in For the Record program number 344. And we're going to take a look at Genoux, his connections to Carlos the Jackal, his connections in turn to attorney Jacques Vergès, the attorney not only for Carlos at one point, but also someone associated with Habash, and the attorney for Klaus Barbie. And I'm going to review some more of the interesting links here in a few minutes. By the way, the use of Kevin Coogan's text here should not be misunderstood as constituting endorsement by Kevin Coogan for the working hypothesis I presented on September 11th. Of François Genoux and his connections to George Habash, the brother of Fuad Habash, we read, on May 30, 1996, an obscure Swiss banker named François Genoux committed suicide in Geneva, Switzerland. From the brief mention of his death in the New York Times, one would not know that one of the most important figures in the history of 20th century terrorism had died. And how many men can say that they were friends with both Adolf Hitler and Carlos the Jackal, skipping down? Genoux was in the thick of things, having established a friendship with SS General Karl Wolff, leader of the German team in Italy that negotiated Operation Sunrise with Dulles. Shortly after the war, Genoux acquired the publishing rights to the works of Adolf Hitler, Martin Bormann, and Joseph Goebbels. He also played a major, if murky, role in aiding fugitive Nazi war criminals. Skipping down still further, speaking of the relationship between Genoux and Jacques Vergès, after the war in Algeria, Genoux met an ultra-left French lawyer named Jacques Vergès, who represented a number of FLN militants accused of terrorist bombings in Algiers' French section. By the way, the FLN was the Algerian organization that was struggling against the French governance of Algeria, a former French colony. Skipping down. After the 1967 war, Genoux and Vergès would reunite to support the Arab struggle against Israel. On February 18, 1969, members